Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update from the Recording Library of West Texas for Wednesday, October 14th, 2020. I'm Michael, and here are some of the stories that we'll be bringing you this afternoon. Hunker down. The fall COVID-19 surge is here. Coronavirus vaccine may be effective only half the time, British task force head warns. Cases emerge of rare hearing loss after COVID-19. New reports show coronavirus immunity can last for months. High humidity could limit coronavirus transmission, Japanese researchers find. Small household gatherings are helping drive the surge of COVID-19 cases, CDC chief says. Client in spin class studio that followed all the rules triggers outbreak with at least 61 cases. Those stories and more will be coming up this hour. I'll also be bringing you several pre-recorded reports. These reports that will try and bring you as many of as we have time for today, they will focus on everyday people, what they're doing, how they are suffering during the pandemic, and also opportunities and how people are trying to help those who need it. Those reports are coming up later this hour. First, let's look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County, total cases, both confirmed and probable, 5,409. Ector County negative, 24,682 out of 30,438 tested, with 347 pending, 104 deaths. Recovered, 4,520. Active, 785. ECISD daily cases, 8 students, 4 staff. Midland County, 4,244 confirmed, 86 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, COVID-19 hospitalizations in Texas increased slightly after a September plateau. Average new cases increased by 318 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 13th, 5,209 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 659 patients compared with a week ago. As of October 13th, 4,053 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths stayed the same compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 13th, 64 new deaths were reported. At the moment, I'm looking at a map of the United States. This map shows that green are states or counties throughout the United States where cases are trending downward. Orange or red and shades of those are counties and states where the cases are increasing. The map I'm looking at today, there is no green in the United States. This map is completely covered in shades of orange, light red, dark red. So in other words, we have no areas, no counties in the United States where cases of coronavirus are trending downward. West Texas Intermediate crude is trading at $40.85. That's up 62 cents. Now here are coronavirus briefs. Scientists pushing to allow the novel coronavirus to circulate freely among healthy young people until herd immunity is reached have found a receptive audience inside the White House, where officials say the controversial approach is in line with President Trump's existing strategy. Top infectious disease experts say the idea is unworkable and far too dangerous, and the World Health Organization recently condemned the approach as unethical. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on Tuesday announced plans to take up a narrow coronavirus relief bill next week and was immediately undermined by President Trump, who tweeted in all caps, "Stimulus, go big or go home." Later Tuesday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi had a contentious exchange with CNN's Wolf Blitzer over her unwillingness to compromise on a $1.8 trillion deal offered by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. I earlier had larger stories that I was going to read about these things, and I even had a clip of that particular interview that I had intended to play, and I've decided against doing that because I'm afraid, as tired of politics as everyone is right now, if I go too far into the weeds with that, you might turn off the radio and miss the other stories. And I would rather just skip over that political stuff where you can probably hear it other places, such as the Wall Street Journal and USA Today, and focus on the medical aspects of coronavirus, because these are things that I really feel that you should hear. So moving over to other stories. Eli Lilly said Tuesday that it was pausing a trial of its monoclonal antibody treatment for COVID-19 in hospitalized patients out of an abundance of caution. The treatment is the same class of medicine that President Trump received and that he has credited with his swift recovery, even though it is impossible to tell how much any drug contributed. Multiple European countries continued to tighten restrictions on Wednesday as a long-anticipated fall surge in coronavirus infections added pressure on health systems, schools, and businesses. The United States reported 52,406 new cases of COVID-19 and 802 virus-related fatalities on Tuesday, according to Johns Hopkins University. Global coronavirus cases now surpass 38 million. The U.S., India, and Brazil account for more than half of the world's recorded infections. 90 members of the Hong Kong Philharmonic Orchestra must quarantine after a musician tests positive. Pfizer to start testing its COVID-19 vaccine in children as young as 12. Labor Secretary's wife, who was at Rose Garden event, tests positive for coronavirus. Dustin Johnson, the world's top-ranked golfer, has withdrawn from this week's Psy Cup tournament in Las Vegas after testing positive for the novel coronavirus. Now here are some articles. Hunker Down, the Fall COVID-19 Surge is Here, from CNN's Christina Maxoras and Holly Yan. As predicted, the United States is now grappling with a new COVID-19 surge, one that could overwhelm hospitals, kill thousands of Americans a day by January, and leave even young survivors with long-term complications. We went down to the lowest point lately in early September, around 30,000 to 35,000 new cases a day. Now we're back up to about 50,000 new cases a day, and it's going to continue to rise, Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, said Tuesday. This is the fall-winter surge that everyone was worried about, and now it's happening. And it's happening especially in the northern Midwest, and the northern states are getting hit very hard, Wisconsin, Montana, the Dakotas, but it's going to be nationally soon enough. Across the country, more than 30 states have reported more COVID-19 cases this past week than they reported the previous week, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. And Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, sounded an alarm about certain states' test positivity rates, saying they may be a good indicator that steeper climbs in case rates are ahead. For the whole country, test positivity rate averaged 5.1% over the past week as of Tuesday, but in at least 13 states, the figure was above 10%. You'd like to see the rates less than 3%. Optimally, 1% or less. Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said at an event hosted by the College of American Pathologists, "We're starting to see a number of states well above that, which is often, in fact invariably, highly predictive of a resurgence of cases, which historically we know leads to an increase in hospitalizations and then ultimately an increase in deaths," he said. Coronavirus vaccine may be effective only half the time, British task force head warns, by the Washington Post's Antonia Farzan. Don't assume that a coronavirus vaccine will be effective more than half the time, the head of Britain's task force cautioned Wednesday. The vaccines we have for flu are about 50% effective, Kate Bingham, who chairs the British Vaccine Task Force, told The Telegram. We shouldn't assume it's going to be better than a flu vaccine because that's an equivalent. It's a mutating respiratory virus that gets in through the nose and eyes and respiratory tract. Midway through last year's flu season, a series of six European studies that covered 10 nations found that effectiveness ranged from 29% to 61%. In 2019, U.S. estimates placed that year's flu shot effectiveness at 47%. In a Tuesday interview with Sky News, Bingham emphasized that a potential first wave of coronavirus vaccines would probably not be enough to end the pandemic, since it is unclear how effective they will be and how long the protection will last. However, a partially effective vaccine is better than no vaccine at all, Bingham said. Although flu vaccines are often effective only half the time, they have a big impact on reducing the clinical impacts of flu in the population, she added. British regulators expect to receive data on two potential vaccines that are in late-stage trials, one being developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, the other by Pfizer and BioNTech, in a matter of weeks, Bingham said. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration will require an eventual coronavirus vaccine to be 50% effective. But Anthony S. Fauci, the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said in August that we don't know whether the efficacy will be any higher than that. Cases emerge of rare hearing loss after COVID-19 from CNN Health's Jacqueline Howard and Elizabeth Cohen. Health authorities around the world have reported the loss of taste and smell as clear symptoms of COVID-19 infection. Now researchers are investigating after new cases of hearing loss with COVID-19 infections emerged. Among them is a 45-year-old man in Britain. The case study, published in the British medical journal's BMJ Case Reports on Tuesday, describes how the man, who also has asthma, saw an otolaryngology specialist following a week of hearing loss while he was being treated in the hospital for COVID-19. The patient was treated with steroids for his hearing loss, and he completed a 7-day course, which resulted in just partial improvement in his hearing, according to the journal. This is the first reported case of sensorineural hearing loss following COVID-19 infection in the UK, the researchers wrote. Given the widespread presence of the virus in the population and the significant morbidity of hearing loss, it is important to investigate this further. The researchers from the University College London and Royal National Throat, Nose, and Ear Hospital noted that there have been a few other reported cases of hearing loss following COVID-19 infection. New reports show coronavirus immunity can last for months, from CNN Health's Maggie Fox. Three new reports just published show coronavirus immunity can last for months, and maybe even longer. The findings suggest that many, if not most, people who recover from coronavirus infections are protected for at least a period of time. They also suggest that coronavirus vaccines may be able to protect people for more than just a few weeks. One study found that people produce antibodies against coronavirus that last for at least 5 to 7 months. We have one person that is 7 months out. We have a handful of people that are 5 to 7 months out. Deepta Bhattacharya, an MU biologist at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, told CNN. We conclude that neutralizing antibodies are stably produced for at least 5 to 7 months after SARS-CoV-2 infection, his team wrote in a report published in the journal Immunity. They have been working with county officials to test volunteers in Arizona since April 30th, ever since they developed a blood test for coronavirus. Like many researchers, they found antibodies to the coronavirus spiked immediately following infection and then crashed. But a few cells, known as B cells, stayed around and kept producing antibodies, whose levels built up again over time. People who were sicker had a stronger immune response, Bhattacharya said. The people sampled from the ICU had higher levels of antibodies than people who had milder disease. He doesn't yet know what that will mean for long-term immunity. Two other studies also support the idea of long-lasting immunity. High humidity could limit coronavirus transmission, Japanese researchers find, by The Washington Post's Antonia Farzan. New research out of Japan suggests that airborne coronavirus particles travel farther in dry environments, potentially making humidifiers a valuable tool for fighting contagion. The study is the latest from Japanese research institute RIKEN, which has been using the world's top supercomputer, Fugaku, to model how the coronavirus spreads in different scenarios. Partnering with Kobe University, the institute analyzed different indoor settings to determine how microscopic virus particles travel after being discharged by an infected person, according to Reuters. At higher humidity levels, particles hung in the air for shorter periods and were less likely to reach someone seated on the opposite side of a dining table, the researchers found. The simulations showed that the amount of particles in the air was more than twice as high when humidity was below 30% than when it rose above 60%. The findings suggest that dry indoor conditions could make the winter months particularly dangerous, the researchers said Tuesday, according to Reuters. They also proposed that humidifiers could be used to lessen, though not eliminate, the risk of transmission in poorly ventilated spaces. Previous simulations using Fugaku prompted RIKEN to recommend keeping windows open on commuter trains and using masks instead of face shields. Small household gatherings are helping drive the surge of COVID-19 cases, CDC chief says. From CNN's Christina Maxoras. Small gatherings are becoming a growing source of COVID-19 spread, a leading health expert said, as at least 36 states are now reporting increased cases of the virus and hospitalizations are on the rise nationwide. In the public square, we're seeing a higher degree of vigilance and mitigation steps in many jurisdictions, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Robert Redfield said during a call with the nation's governors on Tuesday. Audio of the call was obtained by CNN. But what we're seeing as the increasing threat right now is actually acquisition of infection through small household gatherings, Redfield said. Particularly with Thanksgiving coming up, we think it's really important to stress the vigilance of those continued mitigation steps in the household setting. White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator Dr. Deborah Birx echoed Redfield's warning last week, urging Americans not to let their guard down during the holidays by gathering with close friends and family who they think may be virus-free. That's especially important to keep in mind as college students begin returning home. Experts have warned that young students who often show mild or no symptoms at all can contribute to a household spread of the virus by infecting their parents, who may then go on to infect other parts of their home and community. The warnings come as the U.S. sees early signs of what experts say will be another COVID-19 surge, one that could overwhelm the healthcare system and kill thousands more Americans in the coming months. Client in spin studio that followed all the rules triggers outbreak with at least 61 cases. From CNN's Paula Newton and Lee Azomash. A spin studio in Canada that public health officials say followed all COVID-19 protocols is now reporting 61 positive cases of the disease, and as many as 100 staff, clients, and family members may have been exposed. Spin Co. in Hamilton, Ontario, just reopened in July and had all the right protocols in place, including screening of staff and attendees, tracking all those in attendance at each class, masking before and after classes, laundering towels, and cleaning the rooms within 30 minutes of a complete class, said Dr. Elizabeth Richardson, Hamilton's medical officer of health, in a statement. But it still wasn't enough. Public health officials are very concerned about the number of cases and the size of the outbreak, especially because the city is not currently a hotspot and the facility was not ignoring health protocols, they said in a statement to CNN. They have also supported public health services in our investigation by sharing the messaging with all their members, Richardson said. There are currently 44 confirmed positive primary cases associated with SpinCo and 17 confirmed secondary cases. Exposure was linked to several classes held from September 28th to October 4th. Can antimicrobial fashion protect you from the coronavirus? From CNN. With no end to the global pandemic in sight, fashion and sportswear brands have been quickly adapting their lines to include face masks decorated with logos and stylish patterns. While cloth masks made of traditional materials can help slow the spread of COVID-19, according to the World Health Organization, some labels are going one step further. They're marketing new accessories, and in some cases entire clothing lines, as having antimicrobial properties, applications that inhibit the growth of microorganisms such as bacteria and fungi or reduce viral activity. But what does antimicrobial fashion do, and can it provide extra protection during a pandemic? In recent months, brands including Burberry have introduced masks that they claim are protected from microbes and germs. Burberry's forthcoming beige and blue designs come in the label's signature check. Under Armour's multi-layered UA sports mask, which is marketed as having antimicrobial properties, sold out in under an hour when it was released this summer. And Diesel is selling denim that it claims is virus-fighting. The Italian brand announced that it will use a technology called Viral Off, which it says physically halts 99% of any viral activity, in a number of items in its spring-summer 2021 collection. Viral Off works by interacting with key proteins, inhibiting the virus from attaching to textile fibers, reads Diesel's press release. In the U.S., brands cannot claim that products will protect wearers from SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, without providing sufficient evidence. Therefore, some labels simply allude to extra protection or hygiene, though the small print often reveals that antimicrobial treatments are only intended to inhibit bacterial or viral growth, not protect the user from pathogens. Washing garments with soap once a day, as recommended by the World Health Organization, can also kill bacteria and viruses. How to safely socialize as Halloween and Thanksgiving approach, from CNN's Adrian Vogt. Small gatherings are fueling the spread of coronavirus, according to U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Robert Redfield. So, with Halloween and Thanksgiving coming up, how can people plan for the holidays? Dr. Megan Rainey, an emergency physician and Brown University researcher, said that her kids are still going trick-or-treating, but they are wearing their cloth masks and washing their hands before eating candy. She is doing a Zoom Thanksgiving with her parents. If you're still sitting a foot away from other people without a mask, you can still spread it, especially if you're in that very infectious period. Just because someone is close family does not mean that they're safe either, she said on CNN's New Day. Olga Kazan, a writer for The Atlantic, spoke with experts who gave advice about holding indoor events. One of the researchers that I talked to for this said that part of deciding where you're going to spend your kind of risk for COVID is how important it is to you. If Thanksgiving is a really important holiday to you, maybe take extra precautions, get tested, quarantine ahead of time, and maybe you can do something small, she said. Researchers told Kazan that if you're planning on holding an indoor event, keep it small and keep an eye on the infection rate in your town. What experts really told me is that if you're going to have an indoor gathering, first of all, you want to keep it small. It's going to be a risk no matter what, she said. But you want to make sure that the number of new cases in your immediate area is between 5 and 10 per 100,000 people, and that the test positivity rate, that's the number of tests that are coming back positive per all of the tests that are taken, is less than 5%. Now let's go to our pre-recorded reports for today. The first is from the Texas Standard, and we mentioned this in the news yesterday. As COVID-19 cases explode in El Paso, prevention measures appear to have broken down.
Despite coronavirus concerns in places like Harris County, home to Houston, voters greeted by long lines toughed out the wait and set new records on a first day of early voting. But the nexus of early voting and the pandemic is especially notable out west in El Paso, where that city is experiencing what the news team at El Paso Matters now describes as a second wave of COVID-19 infections, even as El Pasoans head to the polls. Robert Moore, the founder of El Paso Matters, is covering this story. Bob, welcome back to The Standard.
Thanks for having me, David. I appreciate it.
First things first, a lot of people hear second wave and they wonder, did the first wave ever end? Tell us about what you're seeing out in El Paso.
Yeah, you can see a really clear pattern in El Paso. And you know, through like early July, is very similar to what you're seeing in the rest of Texas. So we peaked at about 2,600 new weekly cases early in July, and then went into what was at first a gradual decline, and then a really sharp decline. So by the time Labor Day weekend rolls around, we're only reporting a little over 500 new cases a week. So we fell from this peak of about 2,600 down to 500 cases, and everybody really starts feeling good about themselves. And then, unfortunately, maybe a little too good, and things broke down a little bit. And after the Labor Day weekend, you see the case counts go back up, first gradually, and then the last couple of weeks extremely sharply. So last week, we wound up having about 3,000 new cases. So again, that's up from that low of around 500. And so we were much, much higher than even in that first wave. So we're on track this week for maybe another 2,800 cases or so.
Wow.
So when you chart this out, the wave function really kind of stares right at you. You had the first wave building in the summer, then it starts to decline a little bit, and then right around Labor Day, boom, the next wave comes back up.
Bob, clearly this is ringing alarm bells in the governor's office. He's sending new resources to El Paso. Tell us more.
Yeah, so he dispatched some medical help, nurses, techs, and others, some additional PPE, along with the case count I just talked about. We're seeing an extremely alarming rise in hospitalizations. I checked this morning, the hospitalization count's up above 370 for the first time, and again, that peaked at a little over 300 in the summer. So a massive rise, and you're beginning to see the strains on the hospitals. And of course, the big concern is we've got flu season right around the corner. So if we can't get these COVID cases under control, you could have this it's an awful collision. And one of the things the governor likes to look at, it's a measure I don't think a lot of other epidemiologists are particularly impressed with, but he likes to look at the percentage of all cases in the hospital that are related to COVID-19. And he's sort of set this threshold at 15%. As sort of being the dividing line. Well, we're at about 25% in El Paso.
Wow.
About a quarter of all the hospitalized cases are COVID cases.
What are health experts saying about the ability of the local infrastructure to cope with that rising number?
They're obviously worried, especially because of the flu season out there. We're not in the situation where the Rio Grande Valley was earlier this year, for example, or other areas we've seen where the hospital system was completely overwhelmed. We still have some capacity there, and we have, we've got really smart people running our hospital systems, and they know how to ramp up and make adjustments. But, if we continue on this trend, especially as flu season lurks, we will risk overwhelming our hospital capacity.
Bob, you mentioned people are letting down their guard. What about ordinances to try to deal with this spike?
The governor has really removed that authority from local governments. There's not a whole lot in terms of ordinances that the city government can do right now to try to put further restrictions out there.
What about the impact on early voting? Is this having any effect that you can tell?
Well, people obviously are concerned about it, but like a lot of other communities in Texas, we had record first day turnout yesterday. It was 75% higher than in 2016, including in person. We set a record of almost 19,000 people. The elections office has taken extreme measures to try to protect people as they vote. They give them Q-tips to mark their electronic ballot. You sign in by putting a finger condom on and writing your your signature with your index finger. So it's just extraordinary precautions.
Taking extra measures, clearly. Bob Moore is the founder of El Paso Matters. We'll link to his latest, texasstandard.org. Bob, thanks again.
Thank you.
Now another report from the Texas Standard today. As stimulus talks break down, the fate of many Texas restaurants remains uncertain. It's very hard when you have a restaurant owner who is calling in tears that's been in business for 50 years, saying, "We've been feeding Texans this entire crisis." Here's this report.
Around a month ago, Governor Greg Abbott gave the order loosening COVID restrictions, including allowing restaurants to operate at 75% capacity. Still, not all is well in the world of Texas restaurants. Popular eateries around the state have shuttered. Icons like Austin's Thread Guilds, which closed after nearly 90 years in business. And even those that have survived still face a long road ahead to economic recovery, made even tougher by stalled stimulus talks. In fact, the Texas Restaurant Association is telling eateries in the Lone Star State not to hold their hopes up for another stimulus payout. Joining us now, Emily Williams-Knight. She is CEO of the Texas Restaurant Association. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Is there a clear picture yet of just how badly the pandemic has hurt the restaurant industry in Texas? Any numbers, for instance, on how many restaurants have actually shuttered?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty alarming to think back on the first of the year, which I think is even hard for all of us to even go back that far now. And we had 50,000 restaurants in Texas that employed about 1.3 million people. We were actually the second largest private employer and contributed about $70 billion to the Texas economy. And as we talk about those stalled talks, we've lost about 15% permanently. Wow. Of that 50,000. And with Congress's inability to cross the stimulus package, we think it could be another 10%. And the winter's going to be quite hard for us.
Let's talk a little bit more about stimulus. I understand you aren't optimistic that another round of stimulus checks and relief for businesses will be forthcoming, or that it will save restaurants in Texas. Can you say a little bit more when it comes to that?
Sure. You know, if we go back, it was really the first week of August when our congressional leaders went home, and that was the first sort of, this is not going to happen. And it was very hard for us because we really thought we were there. The Paycheck Protection Program had been put into every single bill, a second round. We knew it was what we needed. We needed that and some employee tax credits, some liability protection. All of these elements had been discussed, but more importantly, that stimulus was in every bill from both the House and the Senate. And when it didn't clear, we've literally been in limbo now since the first week of August, and it is a back and forth game. And even as I talk to you right now, there is this opportunity of potentially a $1.8 trillion package, but we're not sure what's in there for restaurants or even small business. And so if you've been holding on for many months, literally, you are stuck in partisan politics wondering what the future is of, frankly, your livelihood. And I have to say, just sitting here, it's very hard when you have a restaurant owner that's calling in tears, that's been in business for 50 years, and because we can't get Congress to agree with, you know, between themselves or the White House, it's a really tough message to deliver. It feels incredibly unfair as we've been feeding Texans this entire crisis.
What'll it take to keep the lights on for Texas's restaurants?
Yeah, we need sort of three things, right? We need the governor to extend us to 100%. And I have to say that's been a great partnership. And we are one of the few states that actually are at 75 and operating under the conditions that we are. So we'd like to see that continue to get to 100%. There's no evidence that restaurants are risky in any health data that we've seen. We need, you know, customers to come out. We need customers to understand that dining rooms are safe. And if they don't want to dine in, there's never been a better time than the fall in Texas to dine outside, maybe buy a gift card or take food to go. And the third is we absolutely need Congress to pass a stimulus bill that will provide some protection and some essentially cash flow to these restaurants to help them get through what now has been 8 weeks of support we have received for a 7-month problem.
In the meantime, though, how do you advise restaurants when it comes to adapting to the circumstances that they're faced with on the ground right now?
We were able to pass a number of executive orders that everything from alcohol to go, mixed drinks to go, selling retail items, working with the comptroller on tax deferrals. Unfortunately, right, there are little things that do pile up into being something significant. So we're telling restaurants that we're seeing curbside and delivery maintain as very strong elements. So if they don't have those things in their restaurant, they've got to think about that. Think about how they can expand their parking lot spaces or their driveways or their curbs out front. We've had a lot of support from the local city officials to allow restaurants restaurants to expand into those regions and have people dine outside. But this is a time where we're telling restaurants you have to be more creative than ever. And most importantly, do not be thinking about March 1st. We are never going to go back to what early March looked like in this industry ever again.
What do you think the restaurant industry in Texas is going to look like on the other side of this? I mean, you mentioned there's no returning to what it was like in early March. Are there some changes to the way restaurants will operate that you believe are here to stay?
I think you're going to see a smaller footprint going forward. I think the very large scale, large footprint restaurants, I think you're going to start to see those decrease in size. My greatest concern are some of the restaurants that you mentioned at the start, right? It's our independents that have been operating for so long that are family owned that we can't afford to lose. And that's probably the greatest risk of the landscape changing. But I do think if you look collectively, and there's some data coming out that Texas is so well positioned to recover in the sector over time. It's going to take us at least 2 to 3 years to get there. But you can already see some green shoots of restaurants opening and chains moving to Texas. And as long as we remain business friendly, I think we will recover faster than some of our, you know, unfortunately, our restaurant colleagues up in the Northeast or Pac Northwest.
Emily Williams-Knight is CEO of the Texas Restaurant Association. Thanks so much for your time.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Now, moving from business owners to those who are unemployed, here's a report from NPR. So hard to prove you exist. Flawed fraud protections deny unemployment to millions.
During the pandemic, state unemployment systems have become a target for organized crime rings. They steal money through fraudulent claims. But arguably, a bigger problem is that some of the systems in place to prevent fraud like that have been hurting millions of innocent people. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
When Sevi Guash lost his job as a food and beverage manager at a Marriott hotel near San Jose, he figured, okay, I'll apply for unemployment. This was back in March. He went online, put in his info, waited for weeks, couldn't get through on the phone. After more than a month, he was told to mail in more proof of his identity.
My driver's license, picture of my passport, copy of my W-2. She said the more documentation that I could put in there to prove who I was would help out my case.
Help out his case. Guash had clearly lost his job with a big company. He had ID. What was the problem? But this dragged on and on. Weeks would go by, they'd need another document, and 6 months later, Guash still hadn't gotten any unemployment money, and he can't find another job.
I had about $17,000 saved.
Guash is 32 years old, and he'd been saving up to go back to community college to try to become a computer programmer. He moved into a smaller apartment to save money, but he still had to drain that entire savings for college. There's not enough left to pay rent next month.
I got to watch what I worked really hard to get dwindle away. I don't want to get angry in front of you for the interview, but it has been really, really frustrating.
And the whole thing just seems so Kafka-esque and avoidable to him.
It's so hard to just prove that you exist.
In California alone, millions of people are having a hard time proving they exist as they struggle to get the unemployment benefits that they deserve. And it turns out Guash is right. A lot of this was completely unnecessary. All right, so to understand what's going on, let's just say that I was going to apply for unemployment.
And you had written Christopher Arnold, but your Social Security card said Chris Arnold. Or something like that.
That's Jennifer Palka. She was brought in by the state of California over the summer to co-chair a strike team to figure out why there were such massive delays. She was a top technology advisor in the Obama White House. So, like she said, maybe I forgot to enter my middle initial or something minor.
It's not that hard to tell that you're the same person.
But Palka and her strike team found out that that would send up a warning that, uh-oh, could be fraud. We need to do what's called further identity verification. And that means a manual review. People have to review your case. People swamped with 10 times the normal number of claims.
Right. So if you applied for unemployment assistance, you had a 40% chance of getting flagged for manual processing.
For the vast majority, it was for this ID verification. This is what appears to have happened to Guash. And Palka found that many other people suffered through traumatically long delays.
Those 40% of people, which is a lot, had very little chance of getting paid in any reasonable time frame.
At a hearing with lawmakers in July, Sharon Hilliard, the head of the California Unemployment System, or EDD, apologized to those people.
Most importantly, what I want to make sure everyone understands is that EDD sincerely regrets any payment delays.
But Polka's strike team realized that the payment delays, they just didn't need to happen. All this ID verification to try to stop fraud, it was completely outdated.
Sadly, they haven't been protecting the system from much fraud. They catch very few people.
Like really, really very few people. Remember, her report found that 40% of the people applying for benefits face these big delays. So millions of people who deserve benefits are getting hung up in this net. How much actual fraud is that successfully catching?
Less than 0.5% of people, less than 0.5% of people are caught as fraudulent through this tactic.
This is not just a problem in California. Millions of people around the country are facing big delays. By one count, 15 million Americans who filed for unemployment still haven't gotten any benefits. And experts say outdated fraud prevention systems are a big part of the problem. But at least in California, things are finally changing. The state has followed a recommendation from the strike team and brought in an outside company with a much more sophisticated system. So Palka says starting as of just a few days ago, people can now verify their identity very quickly when they apply just using their phone.
It actually asks you to take a photo of your ID, probably your driver's license, right then and there. And then it actually asks you to take a selfie. And it's then drawing on many different databases in a very sophisticated way to really understand if you are who you are.
Palka says a lot of people are working very hard in the state unemployment office, but the hope is that 90% of applicants can now get processed quickly and avoid the dreaded manual review. For his part, Sevi Guash, who had to spend his college savings, says that he spoke to a representative late last week.
She let me know that I'm literally ready. They have all of my information entered.
But someone with more authority still had to give the final approval.
So I found out I'm waiting on my mysterious hero, wherever they may be.
That mysterious hero just came through. Guash tells us more than 6 months after he applied, his account now shows that the state has finally started paying him his unemployment money. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
And now here's a story about those who are trying to help. Together, mother and daughter social workers face new challenges in a pandemic.
Today, a mother and daughter who help people in the last stages of their lives. Michelle Houston and her daughter Lauren Magana are social workers in the Atlanta area. In 2018, they came to StoryCorps to talk about their work.
My grandmother was dying, and I went to see her, and she was barely speaking, but said to me, "Be happy." So I took that and literally changed my life 180 degrees. I went back home, told your dad that I needed a divorce, and I had dropped out of high school at the age of 17, and I went to college. At 40 years old, I started undergrad program, and now I work with the dying. So that's how it started.
I always tell people when they ask me, why did you become a social worker? I tell them, well, my mom was kicking butt all the way through school, and you humanized people, and you taught me how not to be afraid of people, because people have value. It is a privilege to be a part of, even a small part of their life, and then a privilege to help them move on to wherever is beyond death.
That was 2 years ago. This year, Michelle and Lauren spoke again through StoryCorps Connect. They talked about working with COVID-19 patients.
It has been tragic in ways that, unless you are in this business, would be hard to understand. I've lost several people over these last couple months that I wasn't able to say goodbye to. And so that has been really hard.
Yeah, I called you the other day crying because you're one of the few people that I know that truly understand like how hard our job is. I went to help this man who's well in his 90s. I'm in like a gown and I have two masks on, and I am trying to talk to him and he can't hear. He's hard of hearing. And he started just openly weeping, sobbing. And then he shakily stands up and he grabs me and hugs me and says into my ear, "I can't hug my granddaughter, so I'm gonna hug you." And I started to lose it, and we weren't supposed to touch, but it was so worth it.
Well, this has definitely been a challenging few months, but I just want you to know that I am extremely proud of you, and it is such a privilege to be in this work with you.
I think that I am really, really blessed to be able to know what I want to do and do it and love it and do it with my mom.
Michelle Houston and her daughter, Lauren Magana. Their conversation will be recorded at the Library of Congress.
A couple of weeks ago, we reported about food insecurity in America right now. We have two stories now that are also on that topic. First, grassroots effort fights food insecurity with free food refrigerators. And then, outlining solutions to help end hunger.
More Americans are finding it hard to get enough to eat during the pandemic. The nation's largest food bank network is serving 60% more people. 40% of them are looking for food aid for the first time. One grassroots effort to fight food insecurity is growing in several cities. It's all about free food refrigerators. Here's NPR's Eric Westervelt.
Thaddeus Umster had just finished transporting perilously heavy loads of donated food stacked high on his three-wheel cargo bike when I reached him. The activist was delivering donated produce to outdoor free food refrigerators in the Bed-Stuy section of Brooklyn, where he lives.
About 15 cases of food, mostly sweet potatoes, lots of apples, some corn, some broccoli, and I did like four trips.
A self-described anarchist with a New York City collective called A New World in Our Hearts, Umster helped set up the city's first free food refrigerator back in February. That was right before the pandemic sucker-punched the city, but that knockdown blow also spurred people to action. Armed with thick extension cords and refrigerators, some picked up free on Craigslist, they got to work. There are now almost 60 free food fridges, or freeges as they're often called, across the greater New York City area. The honor system rules are written on the front. Take what you need, leave what you don't. Umster says the people using these modern-day bread lines aren't necessarily the folks you'd expect would be in need.
A lot of them are people who prior to the pandemic had good jobs and didn't have to worry about stuff like that. People from other places that don't qualify for unemployment. Now they've been relying on the fridges to help them sustain themselves.
So far, local health departments and inspectors have mostly looked the other way as this grassroots effort has spread from New York to Nashville, Boston to California. With help from the New York collective, Marina Vergara in L.A. linked up with others interested and dove right in.
Let's try it. And, you know, within a few days, basically, I had a location and I already had two donations.
More donations and a few used refrigerators poured in. As the pandemic grew, so did the need for more food. Scarcity is a myth, Vergara says. Americans waste so much food, and the food fridges, she says, just make sense. By her count, activists have now set up at least a dozen across greater L.A., stocked with fresh and canned items, basics like milk and eggs, veggies, and fruit. For Vergara, the speed and growing support for the fridge movement offers a reason for optimism in an otherwise dark year.
It's incredible how fast this has all happened. I mean, I can't even explain how much hope this gives me. You know, it's really nice to know that we're here for one another.
The group Feeding America projects that by year's end, food insecurity will hit some 54 million Americans. That's a 46% increase since the pandemic hit.
Mother Nature never, ever, ever stops. She just keeps giving you. Look at this.
Several fridges have been set up in Oakland, California as well. And some here wonder if those running them are in it for the long haul or connected deeply enough to the local community.
My name is Brandy Mack. Most people call me Mama B or Sister B.
Mack helped create a fridge here several years ago, but she put it inside Castlemont, a high-poverty high school in East Oakland that's 94% Latinx and African-American. And she stocked it with fresh fruit as well as some veggies grown on site.
I was excited when I heard more people were doing it because they thought I was nuts when I said, we're going to have a fridge in the hallway at the school and the kids can go get what they want when they want it because the issue is they're hungry.
The bigger picture, Mac connected the fridge to an ongoing program. She and others turned an old basketball court into a thriving working farm. And today, part of the school's Sustainable Urban Design Academy teaches young people how to cultivate, process, and distribute healthy food in the area.
You go deeper over there, there are peppers in the bed. You know, it's just a plethora of food.
Brandy Mack worries these pandemic fridges, in contrast, could turn out to be fleeting, feel-good footnotes to a deadly virus.
As we watch this whole United States crumble, we cannot keep employing the savior model. It's yet another Band-Aid. So I will urge for folks who are, you know, excited to offer a distribution model to really think about the sustainability of it, that we no longer can do Superman designs helping communities that have been traumatized.
Still, Max says she welcomes the make-it-happen innovation of plugging in a fridge and getting the Instagram generation involved. Just think it through, map the local food systems, she urges, noting that hunger will still be a scourge long after the virus isn't. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Oakland.
And finally today, we want to focus on solutions to the problem of food insecurity in America. We spent a lot of time today highlighting the problems around how people get food or don't get food and the effect that this has on them. But now we want to focus on what better approaches might look like. To help us think this through, we are joined now by Earthrin Cousin, who's had a long career thinking about these issues. She previously served as U.S. Ambassador for the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and Executive Director of the World Food Program. She's currently the CEO of Food Systems for the Future, which invests in food and agriculture services to improve nutrition in low-income communities. And she's a visiting scholar at the Center on Food Security and the Environment at Stanford University. And she is with us now. Welcome, Ambassador Cousin. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
I'm honored by the privilege to spend time with you.
So one of the sustainable development goals adopted at the UN in 2015 is zero hunger, with a target of ending hunger and malnutrition globally by the year 2030. So when people talk about zero hunger, what does that mean?
That means everyone everywhere would have sufficient access to affordable, nutritious food to meet their dietary requirements. And it is possible.
You've written a lot about the fact that often this issue arises, you know, from conflict, like war. But as we've learned and as we've been talking about throughout this hour, this is a problem in the United States too. So what are one or two things that would make our food systems here in the United States more equitable, would bring us closer to ending hunger here?
When we talk about food security, we're also talking about nutrition. And when you have the malnutrition problem in the United States, which is obesity, and the health consequences that occur from that, what we've realized as a result of COVID is that we have our own set of malnutrition and food-related problems in the United States that are directly related to a food system that does not meet the needs of low-income and underserved populations. But we can, even here in the United States, we can do things that will change that paradigm. We focus on the charitable system, and we should have a charitable system that responds to emergencies, that ensures that people have access to food. But we also need to invest in businesses that can provide access to nutritious foods, that people, giving people the ability to purchase the food that they need to meet their requirements and not just stand in line for a box.
Hmm. Are there things that individuals can do if they don't, you know, own a farm, if they don't, you know, sit on a board of directors? Is there something that people who are listening to our conversation right now could do to help solve this problem?
There are food policy action councils that have sprung up all around the country that your listeners should Google and get involved. There are also new farm-to-consumer systems coming online that will allow for purchase directly from farmers that will make our system more agile by giving people the ability to purchase food that's closer to them. We also have new laws coming on the books that allow for the consumers who are entrepreneurs to begin to develop their own food products and sell them at farmers markets. What we'll find as we move forward is that people get getting involved with their food and knowing the system, knowing who their farmer is, where that food is produced, is going to create a different demand for food in our society that will result in ever more nutritious food becoming available.
You know, the complexity of this, of these issues that, as I said, again, the whole question of poverty and hunger, you know, global conflict, etc., may make some people feel like hopeless, like nothing will work. Is there anything you can share, like a story, maybe a personal experience, that help you to understand that solutions to this problem are possible?
When I was executive director of the World Food Program, I never took pictures with babies with flies on their eyes and bloated bellies, because we've all gotten far too accustomed to seeing that as the face of poverty and hunger. But what I witnessed were men and women who were working as smallholder farmers, as entrepreneurs, to provide for the food needs of their children as well as for the markets that they supported that provided them with income. And so what I always did was take pictures with fat, healthy babies to demonstrate to the world what was possible when the investments were made that allowed people to support their own food needs by creating the businesses, creating the agricultural production, supporting the systems that would ensure the availability of affordable, nutritious food. That demonstrated that we could change the outcome for people by helping them change their own lives.
Ambassador Earthwind Cousin is CEO of Food Systems for the Future. She's also a visiting scholar at the Center on Food Security and the Environment at Stanford University. And she previously served as executive director of the UN's World Food Program from 2012 until 2017. Earthwind Cousin, Ambassador Cousin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michelle.
As always, we ran out of time before I ran out of reports that I wanted to bring you today, but there is always tomorrow. Meanwhile, USA Today with National News is up next. Then we'll have, at 3 o'clock, your local news. Here are what our volunteers will be reading in today's two-hour broadcast. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, board takes on renaming of Lee High School. Local bar owners don't expect changes. Davis says applicants will know board expects goals to be met. Board president said Riddick's departure will not hurt district in finding replacement. From the Odessa American, city-county tax fight rekindles. City files claim with state for part of county's new sales tax money. Early voting attracts crowds. Honor the Blue recognizes local law enforcement. Those stories and more coming up at 3 o'clock with our local newspapers, at 6 o'clock the Wall Street Journal, and then at 7 o'clock tonight, the Center Solutions podcast with our executive director, Bailey Hennis from the Recording Library, as well as Christy Edwards and Melanie Seiss from Centers for Family and Children. Tonight, they'll be discussing in this encore presentation veterans and how they are coping in the pandemic. That coming up at 7 tonight, the Center Solutions podcast. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Thank you, as always, for letting us come into your home. We hope that you find it informative, and we... Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 93 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 70s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-hour Weather Center.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 2 p.m.
Hello, this is Melanie, and I'm reading articles from the Today's USA Today, Wednesday, October 14th, 2020, starting with the money section under the money line column. First item. Social Security checks to rise a mere 1.3% next year. Next year will bring another paltry rise in Social Security checks for older Americans already struggling financially with the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. The 68 million people who rely on Social Security will receive a 1.3% cost of living adjustment next year, the Social Security Administration said on Tuesday. For the average retiree who got a check of $1,523 this year, that would mean an additional $20 a month. Second item. The IMF predicts 4.4% plunge in the global economy. The International Monetary Fund foresees a steep fall in international growth this year as the global economy struggles to recover from the pandemic-induced recession. The IMF estimated Tuesday that the global economy will shrink 4.4% for 2020. That would be the worst annual plunge since the Great Depression.